Another segment of the Grassy Knoll, and it's August 1st, 2006. I didn't need any hints, I know what it is. We have with us today, I guess it's just going to be Victor Thorne from the Dynamic Duo from Wing TV. And Victor, nice to have you back again this month.
Well, thanks for having me on, Viz. Always look forward to it.
Okay. Now, we've been doing things, and we've agreed to do some stuff that's not so heavily political. I mean, everybody gets a good dosage of that. I'm sure there's a lot of addicts out there. But there's other things, I think, on the cultural scene that were just as important. And, in fact, what we're going to talk about today permeates our entire life. And for those who are out there and not as old as I, and I won't say that for you, but their whole lives have been lived in complete propaganda with the advent of 24/7 TV, which was something that was not there as I was growing up. So we're going to talk about Edward Bernays. There is a book out there, Father of Spin by Larry Tye. It is a biography of Bernays, who was a nephew of Sigmund Freud. And Victor, I go back to the Tye interview, which, and also in the conspirators hierarchy, if you folks had that book, you'll see Bernays has an excerpt in there. But how did you come across him, Victor?
Well, I'd always seen this book for years and years, and, you know, at one point just picked it up, and it's not a long book. And anyone who goes to the Wing TV homepage, I put a link on there now. So if they don't want to order through Amazon or anything, it's actually online for free. And it's only a book, probably less than 100 pages, but one of the most seminal books there is to really show how our minds collectively are being framed and being conditioned to do certain things by this invisible government or these people that hide behind the scenes that want us to do certain things. And it's funny when you mention how there's 24/7 news or 24/7 television. We were watching a movie the other night, Lisa and me, and at one point they said, well, you know, we'll go to bed after the TV goes off. And it was a strange thing because I remember when they'd get the, they'd play the Star Spangled Banner and they'd have the flag on the television, and then the channels go off. And nowadays, you know, kids can't conceive of that because TV never goes off. But in them days, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock, whatever, it went off until 6 or 7 the next day. And I hadn't even thought of it until we saw this movie. And then you mentioned it, you know, right then. And, you know, we do certainly live in different times than back then.
Well, you know, it's funny because growing up, I used to rue getting up too early because I had nothing to do. You know, my parents were still asleep, so I couldn't go outside. I wasn't allowed to yet, you know. And then I'd be staring at these test patterns for like half an hour, which kind of explains why I am the way I am.
I mean, I think they should bring back some test patterns every once in a while and just show everybody what it's like.
Yeah, well, yeah. And, of course, then the other thing was in the rare bouts I had as, you know, a teenager, I couldn't sleep once in a while. Man, you had to get to bed or be asleep by the time the late show ended, because after that it was just like,
The rest of the night. Nothing, exactly.
But Bernays is an interesting character. He did write two books in 1928. I believe the first one was Crystallizing Public Opinion, and it was followed by Propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that you have access to Propaganda right now?
Yeah, it's sitting right in front of me.
All right, let me ask you this to start off with. Is there anything that you found seminal or any excerpts that stood out for you that you want to share right now?
Well, really what Bernays was he was someone that was an apologist for propaganda. He was trying to make propaganda legitimate because, let's go back in time and look. As you said, 1928 was when this book was published, okay? Mm-hmm. And before he wrote this book, he, along with other people like Walter Lippmann, were on something called the U.S. Committee on Public Information. Their job was to sell World War I to the public. Okay? So what were they selling exactly? Well, they were selling democracy. That was the product, was democracy, that we have to spread democracy throughout the world. Well, anyone who pays attention to the news nowadays knows that when they see George Bush or the other propagandists on TV, what is the product that they're selling in the Middle East right now? The same product they were selling in World War I, democracy. They're selling democracy to the world. So, being that Bernays was a nephew of Freud, he learned these tricks of the trade from the master himself, and it was what this book really is. It's a manual of mass manipulation. So, after World War I was over, people like Bernays and Walter Lippmann went into the public sector, into the private sector, I'm sorry, and started selling products for big business. So they went from selling democracy to selling dish soap or selling, you know, TV, well, TV dinners was later, but they sold products, soap or anything like that. So they just went from one area to another, but the techniques they used were the exact same ones.
Also, there is a movie, I believe, it's entitled The Candidate with Robert Redford.
Uh-huh, yep.
Who is running for office, I think it was supposed to be, I think, the Senator of California. A lot of people thought this might be, who was it at that time? I'm wondering who the young gun was over in California at that time. It could have been, what's his face, Jerry Brown.
Oh, okay.
But, in essence, they said it wasn't Brown, it was Tunney, who was running at the time. But the thing is, in one scene, Redford grabs his PR guys, who have this complete detachment from him most of the time, and that's played by Peter Boyle.
Mm-hmm.
And he grabs Boyle. Do you remember that scene at all?
No. Well, I don't even know if I've seen that movie, if you want to know the truth.
Early 70s.
Okay.
And so Redford's getting upset with the way he's being packaged, and he says, I want to talk to you. So Boyle says, well, what's the problem? He says, I want to say what I feel. And then Boyle starts writing down on, I think it's a matchbook, and he slides the matchbook over to Redford. He goes, well, I'll give you this one guarantee. And he goes, all right, and Redford opens up the matchbook, and it says, you lose. But as soon as the election's over, and Redford, in fact, has won, they just go off and just leave him right in the room like, okay, what do I do now? Because they're off to the next campaign.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we know a guy right now that left right after the 4th of July. He was doing a local radio show here. And he's been involved in local campaigns in this area, but he got a call from California from one of the Democrats that's running for the Senate in D.C. for one of the big positions, and the money that they threw at him was ungodly, and paying for his transportation back and forth from Pennsylvania to California, and the thing he said was, and this is a guy that was truly one of the last outspoken voices, at least in this area, on the mainstream media, and he says, I don't want to get caught up in that system, the big system, but he says, the kind of money they're offering me, he says, how the hell can I turn it down? And he took it. So he's out in California right now helping this guy run his campaign, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him since, but I'll bet the stories he comes back with are going to be amazing.
One of the paragraphs devoted to the politics by Bernays in the book Propaganda, it states, political campaigns today are all sideshows. He writes this in 1928. Are all sideshows, all bombast, glitter, and speeches. These are for the most part unrelated to the main business of studying the public scientifically, of supplying the public with party, candidate, platform, and performance, and selling the public these ideas and products. And lastly, since politics was the first big business in America, therefore there is a good deal of irony in the fact that business has learned everything that politics has to teach, but that politics has failed to learn very much from business methods of mass distribution of ideas and products, and I would say that that's very much changed.
Well, yeah, and it's eerie when you read this book for the first time, and we're talking before the show, is that this book could have been published yesterday, and nobody would have noticed, except for, you know, some of the references to products or so forth. But, I mean, this book, it's eerie how 80 years ago, this book was like written yesterday.
Also in that book, there is something extremely interesting. I don't think it's coincidental. It may be coincidental with the inauguration of this group. But how this goes, right? How does he refer to public relations people? What is the idiom he uses?
Well, what the thing he uses when he talks about the need for propaganda is this engineering of consent. And what they do is they have it's like a very scientific examination on how to control the mind. So they look at it the way, I mean, Freud, for all of his notions or concepts. Freud actually wanted to study the mind scientifically, and when you come up with things like id, ego, superego, of course none of that stuff can be proven scientifically, but he did take that approach to it, and with propaganda, this is exactly the same thing they were doing with this study, was trying to scientifically control the mind, or how to have people consent to a certain idea, how to engineer this consent.
My reference in the that was couched in the last question I asked you might have been a little bit oblique. What he does throughout the book, and you'll know where I'm going with this, he refers to the PR people as counsel on public relations.
Right.
With a C-O-U-N-S-E-L.
Mm-hmm.
But what's so interesting is that 7 years or 6 years before the writing of this book, what popped up on the shadow government scene in the United States, but the counsel, C-I-L, on foreign relations. So we have counsel on public relations and counsel on foreign relations.
Yeah. And again, when we go back to the use of words, I mean, this isn't a mere coincidence that this was like that. And everyone knows the CFR came from the Round Table in England. And if we go back again, Viz, to this concept of World War I and selling war to the American people, the year before America got into World War I, or the years preceding it, we had this Jekyll Island cabal, which ended up creating the Federal Reserve. Later that year, we had the federal income tax, and then we have this guy named Colonel House, who is the puppet master of the president, Woodrow Wilson. And all of these things are going on, and then you get the propagandists coming in then, because once you create the Federal Reserve, they want to loan money to somebody. They want to loan money to the American government. So how do they get, or how do they create a situation where it's open to lending them money? Well, we have to get America into war. So you have Colonel House there. Then you have the propagandists on the other side then taking out to the American people and selling them the war. So they're into it. And, I mean, it's been the same technique now ever since, even with this latest debacle in the Middle East right now, when there was a good article in Rolling Stone a few months ago that looked into the PR firm that was hired by this current administration to sell the war to the American people. And it's the same exact techniques as it was 80 years ago for World War I. I mean, it's not changing at all. It's the same tricks over and over and over again.
Well, it's because it works.
Yeah. And then what happened then was that after Bernays was done selling the war to the American public, he went in then to the private sector, and he worked for companies like Procter & Gamble, CBS, the big American tobacco companies, General Electric, and he even worked for United Fruit, which the CIA was involved in when they went down to Guatemala in the 1950s and took it over because they wanted to kick United Fruit out of there. So, I mean, these entities are all tied together.
In fact, he takes credit for getting women to smoke in America.
Yeah, that's a pat himself on the back for that, huh?
Well, you know, going back to what you said about Colonel Mandel House, Edward Mandel House, in the university down here, they have a two-volume set of correspondence between House and, I believe, it's Lord Grey, with his British counterpart urging House to urge Wilson to get involved in World War One. Now, of course, that's what they published. That, you know, who knows what really went beyond that. But, yeah, it was almost like a House was Wilson's familiar spirit, much in the same way I think you could say Kissinger was. So there's a president, but there's always somebody behind the president. Of course, a lot of people would consider, I guess, Cheney the House of today.
Or Karl Rove, depending on which way you look at it.
Or a whole bunch of them, the seven-headed Hydra.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, one thing people have to keep in mind was that until World War One, Bernays and these other people that he was involved with, they didn't have tools of mass electronic communication like they did starting with World War One. So in other words, there were newspapers and there were pamphlets, but most of these were localized. Once you had the inception of radio and then television afterward, the whole world changed, because instead of just reaching a local populace, by and large, they now had the ability to reach the entire country simultaneously, and the tool that was placed in their hand must have been mind-boggling because they could reach literally millions of people at a time, and the manipulation quality is off the charts, what they were able to do with it and are still able to do with it. So, I mean, all of these things we have to take into consideration. It was a different time then, and they were the groundbreakers in this field when it comes to mass electronic manipulation of the mind.
There was a time, I guess when I was in a college, when I thought that the powers that be would not necessarily want everybody to have television, and that's because at that time I thought that TV was an informative tool and was necessarily... it's not necessarily an adversary to the government, but would at least be some kind of, voice of truth. And, of course, I was never so wrong as then.
Well, and ideally, you're right. Ideally, that's the way it should be.
Right, and that's the way we're still led to believe. And remember now how far removed we are and the people who listen to this program from remembering that there are millions of people out there who really think the real deal is on the alphabets, and what's even worse... The ones who really think they get it figure out that PBS is the name of the game, and NPR, and the likes.
Well, we were talking to someone like that last night when we were out running around, and he was citing Amy Goodman and PBS and NPR and so forth, and these other left gatekeepers. And we were like, and the guy was pretty well informed about what was going on in the world. But we're like, you really think this is where the truth is coming from? And he's like, yeah, Amy Goodman, she's on the mark. And we're like, you've never heard of a site called leftgatekeepers.com? And he's like, no. And I was like, well, log on to that site, see where her funding comes from, and then come back and tell us that she's not being manipulated, or she doesn't have an agenda also, or she's carrying forth an agenda from those behind her.
At this point, too, I want to tell everybody that if you wish to jump in on this with an anecdote, you want to ask a question, make a comment, whatever, you got three ways of doing it. Thankfully, my computer's back on its legs again. You can send an email to visigoth@hotmail.com. You can Yahoo instant message. It's viz1400. And you also have MSN instant message, which is Visigoth. And so by all means, I'll be watching. And if you want to jump into this as best you can, obviously, through the Internet, by all means, do so.
Mm.
Yeah, so the one thing about TV I thought was that, they really don't want that in every household. Now, of course, we know, but then you take a look at a nation like China, which is going to make sure everybody's got a TV in their house.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that tell you about the propaganda value of such?
Well, that's, all of the, China's being used as the next model, so everything that's been done here is going to be transformed over there, transferred over there, and... As the two best words or the two key words in advertising are new and improved. So everything in China is going to be even more new and improved over there. The techniques, and considering that these people never have known true freedom or democracy in their lives, they're the perfect model society for this new world order type of people. And that's why I think China is the biggest threat on the horizon today, because it's ready made to become a new Orwellian society, very docile, in line, and just a robotic automaton society.
One of the reasons I watch television now is because I don't want to be completely removed from the propaganda they're putting out there, because that gives me an idea of where we're going.
Right, right.
Or at least what these people in the street are being brainwashed with. A comment here in propaganda, if I could. This is Bernays. He writes, as civilization becomes more complex and as the need for invisible government, that's beautiful, has been increasingly demonstrated, the technical means have been invented and developed by which public opinion may be regimented with printing press and newspaper, the telephone, telegraph, radio, and aeroplanes. Ideas can be spread rapidly and even instantaneously across the whole of America. And Coleman's comment was, Bernays had not yet seen how much better television, which was to follow, would do the job.
Oh, absolutely. And when I read that, what I took from it was that as society becomes more complex, their techniques have to become more complex. So it's pretty simple. But I think another thing, Viz, we have to keep in mind is the very elitist aspect of this. And I want to go back to one of Bernays' associates, Walter Lippmann. And this is what he said about democracy. He said that it is impossible in modern mass society, where whose members, by and large, are incapable of lucid thought or clear perceptions. And then he goes on, he says that they're driven by herd instincts and mere prejudice, and that they're not equipped to make decisions or engage in rational discourse. That's why, according to Lippmann, they need this supra-government, this invisible government or this uber-government to do the thinking for society, because according to them, we're not capable of making the proper decisions. And I think you'd agree that this is so elitist, and exactly, if you go and look at all the different quotes from people that are a part of this New World Order, they all have an elitist mentality that we're the simple cattle, the herd, the sheep, and they have to guide us in the proper direction.
Well, in that book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, he is extremely condescending of everybody out there. And you're right, his feeling, and of course he projects exactly what government and the elites think of us, and that is basically useless feeders who need to be told what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, he said that it would even be bad for government if there were too many schools of thought out there, because it would be somewhat chaotic.
Well, you're right, because in propaganda there's one section where they say the perfect model is the two-party system. So then they can control both sides, and if it goes any further than that, it becomes less, and they're less and less able to control the outcome or the output from the candidates. But one more thing with Lippmann, who is really nothing more than this type of disillusioned socialist. Which, you know, a lot of these neocons really are nothing but Trotskyites. But Lippmann says, we are governed, our minds molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. And if anybody lets that rattle around in their brain for a couple minutes, it's a notion that can't settle well with anybody, because he's saying, basically, these invisible manipulators are forming or shaping everything we think and see and taste and hear and on and on.
Also, I would say, folks out there, if you would like to read that about five-page portion of what Coleman writes about Bernays, just send me an email and I'll send you a Word doc attachment, and you can read that for yourself. In fact, what I'll do is later I'll play a clip. It's only a minute 47 seconds long, in which I ask Larry Tye, the biographer of Edward Bernays, whether or not he was aware of the relationship between Bernays and H.G. Wells. And certainly Bernays, well, according to Coleman, spent time in England, which means obviously he was at a couple of think tanks, and then came back west. And obviously if he was with Freud for quite a bit, that puts him in Europe for quite some time, obviously Freud in Austria. And I don't know if I mentioned this, I did to you off the air, but for the folks, the thing is that he did rip off Freud's, a lot of Freud's techniques or I guess you could say, thoughts, concepts, and used them in his advertising campaigns here. Freud did not know that he was being worked for them. And then when he found out, he was rather unhappy with the situation. So by that time, of course, it was too late. But Freud obviously was helped by his nephew Bernays. So there was some kind of commensalism there. But Freud was not aware until after the fact that he was being pumped. So and the other thing is, too, Tye looks at Bernays as being shifty, but not necessarily malevolent. But I think that's more, you know, Tye's spin on Bernays' life. I think this guy was very dangerous.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, Viz, people should read some Freud, because years ago I used to read a lot of Freud and even read one of his short books a couple months ago. But very, very intriguing gentleman, and there's a lot to disagree with what Freud came up with. But just for interesting readings, everyone should read a little bit of Freud, because he was one of the biggies to shape the way our society is today.
Also, Victor, you have on your website a little article about Bernays, right?
Yeah, I just put something up today, just a quick, I think, three or four paragraphs.
All right, folks, if this intrigues you at all or you want to know more about it, I can say this much from memory. I believe the website is LarryTye.com. That's T-Y-E. LarryTye, one word, .com. I believe there's some stuff up there. There will writing the sample chapter, where you could find out more about this guy Bernays, because really, it's true. I mean, the title of the book is Father of Spin, and this guy was the first one to come around and kick off these advertising techniques, which last, up until the present. And, you know, you think back to Fahrenheit 451 by Bradbury,
mm-hmm.
and what always got me was, and we're seeing this happen, of course, do you remember that it got to the point in the future where people had, like, one wall of their living room was a complete a TV screen?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I mean, you know, for the ultimate insensate person. You know, you wonder, too. We know what's going on. But, you know, I'm wondering if they're screwing with TV and the flicker rate and all this other stuff, trying to throw people into what state is it? Is it the beta state?
Well, I mean, if you look at the TVs they're making now, we have 55- and 60-inch screens, so it's not that far from the concept in that book. I mean, they're making screens now that are almost as big as walls.
And with HD and plasma,
right.
You actually, I mean, it's flat as a pancake, and that can be your wall.
Yeah, and then you put surround sound in it also, and you're absorbed right into it.
You know, one of the things that's taking place now, and I think it's extremely palpable, and it's not because I'm so astute. I think it's because, there's something afoot here in mass media to bring us to a certain conclusion. Now, this is twofold. The one that began earlier, a couple of weeks, maybe even a month and a half ago, is the connectivity between Iran and Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know about you, but I mean, it seemed to me, and I spoke about this before, that in the span of only, you know, like 96 hours, I had heard about, oh, the missiles that Hezbollah is using could be made in Iran. Well, by 4 days later, I heard, oh, Lebanon is a proxy of Iran. And I'm like, oh, okay, in 4 days, we've gone from assuming that these missiles are made in Iran to stating the dead bang fact that Iran is using Lebanon as a proxy. And if I'm not mistaken, aren't they using the S word now? Now, isn't Syria getting in on this as well?
Well, you remember, I think it was last week when we spoke on the phone, I was telling you about that guy in the radio, Glenn Beck.
Oh.
And real briefly, what he was saying is that Israel told him that there's word that Israel has a secret spy, that somehow a secret spy infiltrated Israel's government.
Oh, and, yes, I do. I remember now.
And and this secret spy is from China, and he's stealing the secrets that the Americans send to Israel for their weaponry, taking them back to China. China is reverse engineering this technology. Then they're selling them to Iran, which Iran then sells them to Lebanon, to Hezbollah, which then they use against Israel. And it's this whole big circle from Hezbollah to China to Iran, full circle. And I mean, they're bringing the whole thing there all together then. And the absurdity of this, that when you have the Mossad over there that knows more about anything in relationship to intel agencies, they're just going to let this spy or this mole in there steal these secrets on and on and on to take them to China. It's just ludicrous. But this is what these big guys now, and Glenn Beck's like number three in listenership in the country, has a show on CNN, and this is the garbage that he's spewing out there.
Beck emanates out of Tampa. And, you know, when I listen to him, it's like Rush Limbaugh with the class of a dead dog. He's also the creep that was knocking the 9/11 widows and widowers and whatever, you know, those who lost people in 9/11.
Well, when Michael Langston was here visiting us once, we had Glenn Beck on for a couple minutes, and he was doing that precise thing, knocking 9/11. And Michael Langston was so repulsed that he basically like just turned this stuff off because it's not even listenable. This guy is as bad a cretin as anybody out there right now. I think we lost Viz here on our end. All right, folks. Well, it looks like we lost a connection, so I'm going to wait for Viz to call back here. Okay, here it is. All right, I guess we lost you, huh? Hey, Viz.
Yes, you did.
Okay, we're back.
Right, we're back again. Okay, we're back.
All righty.
happen when you come on.
I know. It's becoming part of the routine now.
Yeah, you and we have on Alan Watt.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm in good company, huh?
Well, yeah. The last thing I saw on Alan's website was the black helicopters that have been hovering over his house.
Oh, yeah.
So if you hear any Blackhawks, you know...
Yeah.
You know that you're being watched by the same people.
Yeah. Well, Viz, let's go into this, what Lippman and Bernays, and this, I'm going to bring one other guy into the mix called Ivy Lee. But first, one last thing on Lippman. He says that the purpose of this invisible government is to organize chaos as God did in the beginning. Now, doesn't that sound like Ordo Ob Chaos? You know, the famous motto, order out of chaos. And basically what he's doing is saying, is equating the New World Order to God. Then Bernays comes in and says, well, people have trouble thinking straight. You know, they just can't do it. So what we really need is to be governed by people who have the quality of natural leadership, okay? Then you have this guy, Ivy Lee. And John D. Rockefeller, when he was pulling all his shenanigans with Standard Oil, became the most hated man in America. That's what he was known as. So Rockefeller found this guy, Ivy Lee, another one of the propagandists, and said, I need to clean up my public image because everybody hates me. This can't be good for business. So they came up with this idea that they'd go out and photograph old man Rockefeller handing dimes to little kids on the street, okay? And they put it in the newspapers and so forth. But John D. Rockefeller was such a cheap miser that after a while he says, you know what? We can't keep giving all these kids dimes. So he says, why don't we just change it to nickels? And here's America's first billionaire. And he's such a pinch penny that he changes it from dimes to nickels. But the point is that all of these people went to the propagandists to say, you know, how can we do A, B, C, and D? And the three biggies were Ivy Lee, Lippman, and Bernays.
Also, when you talked about order out of chaos, you couldn't have stated it better. On the very last paragraph of propaganda, Bernays writes, propaganda will never die out. Mm-hmm. Intelligent men must realize that propaganda is the modern instrument by which they can fight for productive ends, and here we go, and help to bring order out of chaos.
Yeah. And so what they do then is they take these same techniques into the advertising world, which is where Bernays ultimately ended up as, and with selling products, whether it's toothpaste or democracy or dish soap, is they didn't want to urge the buyer to demand a product now. Of course, they would like that if someone wants to buy a product now, but the thing was to transform the buyer's very world so that he needed this product all the time, so that they can't live without it. So it wasn't just an immediate thing. They didn't want spontaneous sales like at the cash register when you pick up a Reese's Pieces or a package of gum. They wanted to change people's minds so that all these products they can't ever live without. So they became something like hypnotists or mind controllers. And they also didn't use real explosive or very shocking techniques, but it was very gradual. So it had to be a transformation that would take time, or that would take place over years and decades and so forth. And we go back then to this concept of frogs in the pot, okay? Just keep turning the heat up a little bit until finally, you know, someone born 10 or 20 years ago, this is the world, and at least from their mind, they think this is the way the world's always been, this way. And that's precisely what they wanted.
Yeah, and things don't change. But, you know, you want to go on with a couple of more personages, is that correct?
Well, no, I just wanted to bring those last ones up there for a minute and just show that, you know, there was really a big three or so that were involved in this field. And it cut across everything, government, advertising, the Rockefeller Syndicate, the whole thing. And, you know, they tapped in and realized that the quality these people had for what they wanted to push forward with their agenda, and the only way they could accomplish it was via propaganda.
This is wallowing in the mud a little bit. I'm just going to do this little digression and get back in again, okay?
Mm-hmm.
About Glenn Beck. These are his words. He said, in reference to the scumbags in New Orleans, this is about Katrina time.
Uh-huh.
He says, I didn't think I could hate victims faster than the 9/11 victims. And he says, let's give them money. Let's get this started. He said, didn't. Of the 3,000 victims' families, I don't hate all of them. Probably about 10% of them. And when I see a 9/11 victim family on television or whatever, I'm just like, oh, shut up. I'm so sick of them because they're always complaining. We did our best for them. And again, it's only about 10.
You know, that's the exact same quote that was played that day when Langston was here that just repulsed him to no end. And you have to think now, someone saying something like that, or like Ann Coulter, and who's getting promoted to the very forefront of the national mass media? People like Glenn Beck, people like Ann Coulter, and, you know, this is the poison of society. And there they are being promoted to the top of the top of the dung heap, really.
You know, going back to some of the things that are being used on us today, or what we're seeing happen beyond just this whole Iran situation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of us, every single one of us, never doubted a bit that once they started using the I word on the Hill and then put it out on TV, we knew we were going.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not there yet, but we know we're going. I mean, and it's, you know, what else can we do? I mean, we're sitting in this thing like we're strapped into a roller coaster that goes off the edge of a cliff.
Yeah, and like I always say is we're one spike event away. So it's not if that spike event's going to happen, but when. And you're right, you're right. It's like going up the roller coaster when it takes that first big ascent, and you know what's coming, and your heart starts beating, and you start getting short of breath, and it's only a matter of time until you hit the top, and then whoosh, you fly down the other end. And that's really what our entire, not only nation, but entire world is doing right now, is what we're being subjected to, is we're in that roller coaster waiting for this spike event to happen until we take the big plunge. And Viz, it has to do something to a mass psychology, because you're right. Everybody knows it's there. It's just a matter of when.
The one thing I find truly upsetting in this last month, and I think, you know, I've always said, you know why I believe the way I do. I think the script has been told us already. We go into Iran and we're gonna mark the last epoch for the United States and perhaps of this world. So what I've seen happen in the last month is actually what Orwell wrote about as far as the group hate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things we talked about is the Nazification of the United States, and heretofore we've been saying it's pretty much the province of the government. But I'm starting to see it now spread amongst the population, and this desire to hate and a meanness. I mean, a la Glenn Beck and stuff, and the fact that these guys can be successful. Of course, those are the powers that be who put them there will make sure that they remain successful.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that happened on Sunday, which I could not believe my freaking ears, okay? Bob Schieffer, that old raisin,
uh-huh,
prunehead, on Face the Nation closes out with a commentary, okay? And this is out of context to a certain extent, but it's a statement that shouldn't even be made. It's like it should be excised. He was talking about solutions to the Middle East problem, and everybody should start talking. One of the things he mentioned as, and I know he threw it, it's a throw-out line, but it was still made. He says, we can't kill all the Arabs. There's too many of them. And I mean, I took a look, and I said, I don't believe I heard that.
Well, that's population reduction. Population reduction.
Yes.
Yeah, genocide.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, it's that little bit, that little bite that gets in there, and it soaks into the American psyche.
Yeah.
And well, now, all of a sudden, we're looking at this, you know, and you know the thing is, what he said has so much truth in it. You know, you've got the crazy Christians saying about, you know, we can't let Islam win. Like, there's nobody who's a Muslim who just wants to go to work and come home and raise a family. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they dehumanize them, just like we dehumanize the Vietnamese.
Well, do you remember that song years ago, and I'm not a big fan of his, but Sting from The Police, and he had a song, it was Do Russians Love Their Children? So this was during the Cold War, and I think he was making, it was more tongue-in-cheek than anything else, but making the point that, well, you know, are these Russians, these communists, so horrible that even the communists can't love their own children? And it's the same thing we're doing now. And Viz, you're 100% on the mark about this Nazification of America, because look at for how long now we've seen pictures of George Bush with the little mustache, or George Bush beside Hitler, or we see the United States with the swastika on it. And it's, if we go back 60 years or so to World War II, right now everybody thinks, oh, Nazi Germany, this evil empire, okay? Well, what if we go 60 years into the future and look back, and in 60 years in the future it'll be like, well, the United States of America, that evil empire, that descended of Nazism. And right now, living in this country, everybody, even though we distrust, or most people distrust or don't like what's taking place, we still look at America as the greatest country in the world. But if you go to the rest of the world, they don't have that same sentiment.
No, that's true. And they're not. And they also are not differentiating between a corrupt and an evil government and those governed by it. And
right.
You know what? They're probably going to be right, because most of the population, unless they grab a hold of themselves and realize what's happening to themselves, are going to follow, you know, Hitler Youth and the Bund and everything else. And really, we'll be exactly like our government. We'll be haters rather than mediators. And as I've said before, and I just got an email from Charles Wilcox, who wrote that Transformation of the Republic. And it's like, you know, where can anybody find anything remotely that gets Christians behind? And call it a genocide. Call it whatever you want. I mean, what is on? I mean, is this what Jesus wanted? Are you out of your mind?
Right, right.
You know, when they're playing this thing, you know how I feel about Israel and Jewry and all that stuff, okay? And you've made your views well known. But my point is, why are we backing a corrupt government, one as bad as our own? You know, the state of Israel is not what they talk about in the Bible. I'm sorry, that's a different Israel. It's a spiritual Israel. Now, they may have title to the land. You can argue that. That's fine. But, you know, this whole idea, though, of hating Arabs, and that's what it comes down to, because we've talked about it. You think Americans are going to differentiate in time between Muslims and, you know, Chaldeans or any, you know, or Christians or whatever? I don't think so. One other thing, and I want to bring something up for you also. Here's how crazy it got. There is a family in Sacramento, Victor, who are Pakistani. They've been living in this neighborhood for a long time, surrounded by a long time neighbors. After 9/11, they became an object of harassment that has not ended to this day.
Huh.
And you know what the rip is?
What?
They're Pakistanis, but they're Catholics, and they're devout. I mean, these girls do have a knowledge of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no, I mean, they're not even Muslim. And they're being lumped in with all those Arabs and all those Muslims. So, I mean, you know, it can happen. You see it in a small neighborhood in Sacramento, but that's only a microcosm of what might come.
Yeah.
Now, here's what I wanted to say, too. There's something that's going to go on very shortly. It's going on now, really. That may be a real problem for you in about a month. And that is the debut of the movie World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine after they get this thing out, and there's a reason why they released it now, right? So they can get it out there, fresh in everyone's mind, come 9/11 again.
Right.
And all those who are going to protest it are going to find people fully fueled by that movie and the saccharine nature of it.
And you know who's making it?
I don't even know who is making it.
Oliver Stone! Oliver Stone's the one making it, and people are losing their mind because it's the most, at least from the reports I've read, it's the most neocon-oriented movie they can imagine. So even Oliver Stone ripped the soul out of his chest and has gone to the other side, which I think he's always been on anyway in one form or another. But yeah, Oliver Stone's the one making the movie. How's that for a mind blower?
He gave a little bit away. In JFK.
Uh-huh.
But to most people, he probably endeared himself for the work he did, because they think it's probably the greatest thing ever, you know, since Gone with the Wind. So you get Stone, you know, they get Stone on they get on Stone's side, I should say. And now they're with him, and now he comes out with this, you know, propaganda movie. So, you know, what starts off as good intentions has this, you know, finality to it. Now, did they know 9/11 was going to happen? He certainly might have known.
Yeah.
I mean, as we talk about propagandizing people, this predictive programming that we've been kind of touching upon with Al Neal and Alan Watt and with John Valentini down in Australia, who's been getting all these, he's been researching and others have been, not subliminals, but 9/11 images.
Right. And the timing of it, when they had the Moussaoui trial going on, of course, and they had the release of Flight 93, and there was actually two versions of that, one on television which got the highest ratings ever for the cable network it was on, and then the Hollywood release, the second one, which completely propagandized the Moosawi trial. They were in conjunction with each other, and now you're right, the fifth anniversary of 9/11, and here comes Oliver Stone's movie, and I guess it's about two police officers that get trapped in the rubble of the World Trade Center towers, and very inspirational and very, you know, very Americana and so forth. And I don't think it goes into the conspiracy aspect at all, which is absurd when you consider this Oliver Stone. But yeah, if they put this out a week or so before 9/11 and it's rah, rah, rah America, and if you know, we start really going hot and heavy into the war right then, they start doing their wag the dog and everybody gets the flags, it's going to be mind-blowing.
Yeah, and I really do believe you're going to get a lot of people opposing the protesters of 9/11 who are going to have a bit of an attitude. You know, I mean, what's going to happen is going to happen, but I'm thinking that we're heading into a period where what we saw with Vietnam protests, where there were a lot of protests for a while, and then they turn the dock workers loose on them and the construction workers, you know?
Yeah. Well, I want to, and, you know, that's a very, very real possibility, and we saw some of that even last year at Ground Zero. But I want to get back to what you were saying about this Pakistani family, because it jogs something in my mind, is that when you go into Bernays' book, one of the big things that he really talks about is that they want to modify people's customs. They want to modify and change really everything about them. So if you look at it in this way, people naturally want to be free, okay? But you hear it all the time now. People are willing to give up their freedom for what? Security. And, hey, I don't think people are naturally inclined to hatred, but as you said now, they have the propaganda so hot and heavy for the last nearly 5 years that now if you go to the people sit in front of Fox News or even CNN and the other ones, and you ask them about the Arabs or Muslims, it's like, oh, these degenerate, you know, these awful, rotten people, blah, blah, and they naturally change or modify the customs of people, their very being, to either hate or accept things that they're not naturally inclined to. It'd be like a couple years ago we saw at the circus. We saw these Bengal tigers in cages outside. And I don't think there's any possibility that they'll ever change the Bengal tiger from accepting its state within that little cage outside of the arena. But with people, with human beings, they've modified us to such an extent that we're accepting this whole big brother type of mentality.
Yeah, I think something has occurred in the last month or so. You know, you can't really put a date on when it first began. It just kind of somewhat amorphously moves into our life. But, I mean, just passing by the TV in this kind of like somewhat distracted state of consciousness, sometimes I think makes you a little bit more aware of things that are involved, like with Shepard's statement. You know, I'm getting ready to do something, and I'm not really paying attention to the TV, and then I hear this thing come out, you know, throughout this whole, you know, screed by Schieffer, and I'm like, what? So, I mean, those things are in there, I believe, deliberately, and we're whooping up America. And just watching an advertisement for the new PBS season, you know, programming, Frontline and all that, and Frontline specifically, and some of the sound bites they use, is somebody saying, well, I expect something to happen within the next 2 years. And then another bite goes, these people are patient. I feel like saying, yeah, but what people are we talking about? You know,
well,
not these, you know, characters over in the Middle East, man. It's the ones that are in Manhattan and the ones that are down in the District of Criminals.
Well, and they're planting a seed. And with Schieffer and with his frontline and all this, it's planting a seed so it goes in there and germinates. And the more it's watered and the more it's fertilized by these other propagandists on the news. And really, the way they see the world is as a machine. They want the world to become machine-like. So when it comes to products, when it comes to the advertising world, they can't just wait for a demand to be created for the supply. They want it to be the other way around. So they want us to be producers, consumers. Go to the factory or go to work, produce, consume. It's a big machine, and they can't wait when it comes to the war. They can't wait for the public to ask for a war or to want a war. They have to create the demand for the war themselves, and that's what 9/11 did, and that's what the next spike event is going to do. They can't wait for us. They have to create demand themselves and the next spike event. And if you go back to 9/11, it was almost like a Nazi youth-like reaction where everybody has their little flags on their cars and everybody's ready. You know, 80-year-old grandma's ready to go kill Osama bin Laden and the Arabs. And it's going to be the same thing with this next spike event. It's a machine-like creation of demand.
I want to let everybody know, too, you're listening to the Grassy Knoll, which is being, I guess it's going to be broadcasted later on Wing TV today. Is that correct?
Right. This is the first time we've ever done this. We're simultaneously recording this show, so it's going out live now on Viz's from the Grassy Knoll, and then within the next hour or so, we'll upload it onto our site, and it'll be there also. So we're hoping, we're keeping our fingers crossed that this works all right. But one last thing, Viz, about this creation of demand. Sure. You see it on TV, and there's commercials that are almost this blatant where they say, your children won't love you unless you buy them Choco Crispy cereal or whatever the product is. And they get it that hot and heavy where, you know, they have to create this demand. And George Bush, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. I mean, how more black and white could it be? Your kids won't love you unless you buy them this cereal, or if you don't support this agenda, then you're siding with the terrorists. I mean, it's so blatant what they're doing, yet look at the weeks and days and months after 9/11. I was talking to someone a few days ago, and they said the biggest disappointment they had about 9/11 was how readily the American public just bought it hook, line, and sinker. Go off to war and kill the Arabs. No investigation of what really happened. No insight into, is this the way it took place, or could it have been state-sponsored terrorism? It's just like, wag the dog, let's go to another war. And they just sucked it up 100%.
Well, for instance, the Beck statement about this China linkage is not something I'm sure he thought of. I'm sure that's what he's been told.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to hear little, you know, through gradualism, that's going to be worked. I mean, it's still 2 years off as far as I'm concerned. Like I said, nothing's going to happen before the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. That's all I can tell you.
You know, and I think that's a damn good opinion, because
well, you know what you said before early in the broadcast, that you said they use the same formula time and time again.
Uh huh.
And I say, yeah, because it works. And the thing is, yeah, they bring it out on every new generation. Every generation has had a war. There's been Korea in the 50s. There's been Vietnam 60s and the 70s. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You had a Cold War, which still got the armament and industry up and running. You still had your bad guys. It's just there wasn't really a shooting war, although certainly our military were in a number of places where there were problems, especially in Central America. All right, and now you're looking at Gulf War I and Gulf War II, and now an expanded war. It happens all the time.
And you remember when we were talking on the phone and you mentioned this concept about the Olympics, and you remember what I called them? The Munich, China 1936 Olympics, is that you know, where Hitler was unrolling this great Nazi empire of his, the Third Reich, and I think it's the same thing with China, as they're being unrolled as the next superpower.
And you're also, if you're going to take Brzezinski's formula and his prediction, you're going to have China, Russia involved in this, and already we're hearing about the cooling of relations between the United States and Russia, because those two eventually will descend upon our military. Which by that time will probably have three countries in a row from which they can work, obviously, right?
And you know what the wedge is going to be with Russia? Venezuela. Because there's news reports every day now about how Venezuela is buying the hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons from China, or from Russia, and they're putting them there. They're ready for the United States. And what does Venezuela have? Lots and lots of oil.
Yeah,
so you have this next connection then. United States, Russia, Venezuela. Venezuela, Chavez speaks out against the evil Satan America and George Bush. So just like we were talking before with China, Iran, and Hezbollah, you have Russia and Venezuela too. And it's all right there, Viz.
You know, and the thing that I think folks have to remember, because they get worked into a frenzy, this patriot community, about police state and all this other stuff. But there's only one way in the world that martial law will work, and that is if something has to happen, series of events that will make people beg for it.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be done to us like what we saw in New Orleans after the hurricane. All right, we're going to have to suffer something that's going to make people absolutely beg for protection. And so once they beg for it, that's when they'll be given it. It isn't going to be foisted on them while they're not really ready to do that, if you know what I mean.
Well, and
going back to what you were talking about, security.
Well, see, I have a little bit of a different view on a police state. Is even if one is implemented, the people in control never have wanted a complete police state. And people say, well, why don't they? And it's like a sadist that comes home and kicks the dog. And if the dog growls at it, he comes home the next day and kicks the dog. Well, at some point, if the dog doesn't growl back ever, the sadist doesn't get any satisfaction out of it. So there's always going to be some form of allowed resistance, if only for the sake that those in control, they have nothing else, viz., except for this game. And if everybody completely becomes 1984, okay, there's nothing else. I mean, they like the game. They like the resistance because they already have all the women they want and the yachts and the money and the political power and the business and everything else. There's only one thing left for them, the human chessboard. And it'll never be a complete police state because they like the game and they like the fight. And I don't know if you agree with that or not, but William Burroughs, the great writer, you know, was kind of on the same line when he would talk about control. He says that the only way you can have control is if you have resistance. And if it becomes absolute, the control's no longer any fun.
I was going to play the Larry Tye clip. That's really not necessary. In fact, I'll probably play it during a garage sale in which Tye responds to what I had asked him about the relationship between Wells and Bernays. And on two counts, Bernays said that, yes, Tye said that Bernays was a master manipulator, but that he could not vouch for any relationship between Wells and Bernays, which Coleman obviously states there was. So we won't worry about the clip because we're running out of time as it is. As far as the martial law type of thing, I agree with you, but I think it's going to be stages. I think that we're at the resistance thing that people do like it now or whatever. I do believe there's going to be, probably because of an event, somewhat of a lockdown, so to speak, and that may ease off too, but we're going to be embroiled in a war, and eventually that'll ease off as well. And of course, on the other side of the war, the goal is world government, and that'll be global totalitarianism. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think that'll be a phase, and it may return again too, after we live in the Orwellian world of Winston. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see. Either way, it's going to be a crap sandwich, I think, and people have to be, I think, emotionally prepared, and I do really feel badly or compassionately for those who have children.
Yeah, and as I heard that quote you were talking about, you played it before the show was on, and the thing I gathered from it was just one little snippet where the individual said, the solution to propaganda is more propaganda, and is that where we're at? I mean, when you said the solution to propaganda is more propaganda,
well, yeah.
It's just a continuing cycle.
Of course. And of course. And I think that when you make it bigger and better and louder as it is nowadays, 24/7, I mean, that's exactly what the handlers wanted because, once they can keep you day in and day out, they've got you.
And so clearly black and white, where you have this partisan left and right. And the talk shows, I mean, there's not even news on a lot of these cable shows anymore. It's just you bring in the one flunky from the left, the one flunky from the right, have them argue for 4 or 5 or 6 minutes, and then go to the next segment where you bring the two flunkies in. And it's nothing but rhetoric, ideology,
mm-hmm.
and divide and conquer. That's all it is.
We've been talking with Victor Thorne from Wing TV. The subject's been Edward Bernays and propaganda. Victor, thanks very much for coming on.
Well, it's always great to be here. Thanks.
All right. Well, we'll talk again next month. Bye-bye now.
All right. Have a good day. Thanks, Viz.
Take care.